Hello and welcome back to the Rights and Wrongs podcast. Today is a special episode which will be guest hosted by the host of the Wrong Place Right Crime podcast, Frank Scalise, where he's going to be joined by law enforcement professionals from all over the world. But I don't want to spoil too much, so I'm just going to hand it right over to Frank, and I hope you enjoy this interesting episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast.
Well, greetings, and welcome to a guest-hosted episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast. George Oakes was kind enough to turn the microphone over to me for this episode. I am Frank Scalise. I'll be your host, and I'll be hosting a panel of several different law enforcement professionals to talk about the rift that may exist, or spoiler alert, does exist between many communities and their police departments. What caused that rift, and what we can do to close it, or to at least begin to close it. For this conversation, I reached out to law enforcement professionals. I wanted opinions from within the profession, so people who are either active or retired from the profession but spent a career there, to offer that insider's view, but also be someone who would be appropriately critical of the profession where it needs to be critiqued. So I believe you'll find this to be a very balanced discussion regardless of your political stance. And if you listen to it with an open mind, I think you will learn something from the panelists. Who are those panelists? Well, I will be hosting. My name is Frank Scalise. I was a police officer in Spokane, Washington for 20 years. I was fortunate in my career to serve as a patrol officer and a detective before moving into leadership roles. And ultimately, I retired as a captain. I had the opportunity to command units such as the K-9 unit and the SWAT team, volunteer units, and the entire patrol division when I was a captain. And so I will hopefully provide some of that West Coast perspective. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I am a white male. My ethnicity is Italian and Irish. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. How about the other guests? Well, I very purposefully have assembled a very diverse group of individuals, and I say diverse in pretty much any way you want to apply the word, gender, nationality, ethnic background, the professional aspects of that, where they do their policing, pretty much everything is diverse in this group. So let's meet them. First up is Elizabeth Nguyen. She is the 911 communications manager at the Regina Police Service in Regina, Saskatchewan, and she's been in that role for the past 8 years. She's also a professional accountant and is currently pursuing an executive MBA. As the communications manager there, Elizabeth is a civilian member of the police service. She's married to a police officer, a commissioned member of that service as well. As you probably guessed from the Regina, Saskatchewan part of the description, she is Canadian. Ethnically, both of her parents are Vietnamese. They immigrated to Canada from Vietnam. So she is a Vietnamese and a woman and Canadian. And I think that about covers it. So we'll move on to Larry Scarrato. Larry served in the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In fact, he rose to the position of the Assistant Chief of Professional Standards, and in fact was the youngest assistant chief in the history of the organization. And so he will be able to offer that East Coast policing perspective, as well as being that he was an assistant chief, that executive level view of how organizations work. Larry is multiracial. He has an Italian mother and a black father. He identifies himself as a black man. And for the past 15 years, he's also been the lead ethics and cultural diversity trainer. Lastly, but certainly not leastly, we have Mick Myers. Mick lives in Melbourne, Australia, and he was with the Victoria Police Force for 40 years, spanning from 1974 to 2014, when he retired at the rank of inspector. We would be here all day if I were to list all the things he did during that 40-year career, but suffice it to say that if you spend 40 years at an organization, you've either done or been connected to just about every job that a police service does. He was designated the local area commander for three different municipalities, essentially the equivalent of counties here in the U.S., near the end of his career. As you might have guessed from the location, Mick is Australian. He's native Australian and a white male. So now let's meet the panelists. Fair warning, one of the first questions I ask them is something that is unique about them or different about them that people, perhaps even people they work with, might not be aware of. And so you're going to find out something cool about each of them. It's only fair if I'm asking that question that I also answer it. So I'll go first and share that in addition to my law enforcement career, I'm also an author. I've written over 30 novels, most of them crime fiction, under the pen name of Frank Zaffiro. And so that's my something you may not have known. Let's meet Elizabeth, Mick, and Larry and find out more about them and then dive into our conversation about law enforcement, the communities that they serve, the rift that may exist between them, and how to bridge that gap. Well, I'd like to welcome each of the panelists, and we're going to get into some pretty weighty material, but I thought we might start by just learning something a little bit personal about each of our panelists, specifically maybe something people who know you professionally in your police-related world, something they might not be aware of or something that's a little bit different. Larry, let's start with you.
Hey, thanks, Frank. On a side note, outside of my law enforcement experience, I've been refereeing collegiate basketball for the past 23 years. I've worked the men's basketball tournament, the NCAA tournament, March Madness. I made the Sweet 16 twice, hopefully moving forward, maybe one day making it to the Final Four. But I've been in men's basketball for a majority, almost a parallel my policing career. So that's kind of a fun fact that a lot of people wouldn't know about me.
Being a referee also seems like a natural fit for someone who's been in law enforcement.
It does. And my mom, God bless her soul, when she was alive, she used to say, "Will you ever do something where people aren't constantly screaming at you?" So I think I have this, this desire for some type of conflict one way or the other, whether it's in policing or officiating.
Well, I'm not much of a basketball guy. I'm more of a hockey guy, but I imagine the refereeing dynamic is very similar in all sports. You really can't please everyone, for sure.
Right. 50% of the people think you're wrong 50% of the time.
So let's check in with you, Elizabeth.
I think something that most people in my professional world don't know about me is that I fancy myself an amateur chef. And I actually have like a food Instagram account and a blog that I try to maintain in my spare time. It started off being just a place I wanted to, you know, make note of recipes that I like or recipes that my mom has passed down that I want to keep going. But it's slowly beginning to turn into something that is getting a bit more attention and a bit of like sponsorships and stuff like that, too. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Wow, I wish we were doing this interview in person. We could hire you to cater it.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
And lastly, let's go down under and talk to Mick.
Morning, everyone. Well, Frank, since I've retired, and one of my grandsons has started school, I've become involved at the local primary school mentoring young male students who haven't got a male in their family structure. This is a bit of a male a role model type thing, which is pretty fulfilling. My wife and I, we also work 2 days a week for a Catholic charity called St. Vincent de Paul. I sort out all the CDs, DVDs, and I've, as a result of it, I've become a bit of a quasi-expert on LP vinyl records. I also like to do, amateur military historian, and I've been to quite a few of the battlefields across the world and walk across them and so forth. And I also help people research their family members' involvement in the military during the various wars that Australia's been involved in.
Well, refereeing, food, and mentoring, it doesn't sound like any of the three of you have strayed too far from your career field, even in your outside interests. Well, let's move into the topic at hand, and maybe we should start by just figuring out if we're all on the same page, at least on our foundational thought here. And by that, I mean, the question at hand, and that is there a rift between many communities and their police department? And as you answer this, I guess I'm looking for your thoughts additionally on if you do see a rift, the nature of that rift and maybe a little bit of what the cause of it is. And since we went one direction on the intro piece, let's reverse and start with Mick.
Thanks, Frank. Look, I think across the world, there wouldn't be too many police departments that don't have some form of rift with their society because it's the nature of the beast. It's sometimes, not always, it's a confrontational situation that we find ourselves in. For example, we may wish people to do things they don't want to do. We may want people to move to an area where they don't want to move to, and we may have to take that person's liberty who doesn't want his liberty taken. So I think it boils down to how we handle that and training, discipline, and so forth. Here in Australia, especially my state, Victoria, at the moment, we're going through the COVID problem like the rest of the world. But our state has had a particularly strict lockdown. We've had three different lockdowns, and in fact now we're in our third lockdown. We're locked in for 5 days. We can't travel further than 3 miles from our house, and we can only leave the house for four reasons. Now, people are rejecting this as a breach of civil rights, and the Victoria Police have been given special powers by the government to stop this. So, for example, masks are compulsory, and if you're not wearing a mask in public, you can be arrested. And that is causing all sorts of problems for the police at the moment. The other problem is, I think, is lack of discipline in society. People don't like to be told what to do. They don't get told what to do at home. They don't get told what to do at school. And all of a sudden, there's a police officer telling them what to do. And I think the biggest problem that causes a rift, it works both ways, is that a lot of police and police departments have the must-win mentality. The police must win or society will deteriorate. Now, that can also cause a rift because the police can get a little bit too heavy-handed and to be seen to be, being heavy-handed by society. But on the other side of that too is that the police have an expectation from the public that they must win. If a member of the public calls the police for assistance, 9 out of 10 times they do so because it's a bad problem in the eyes of that person who's calling the police, and they expect the police to arrive swiftly, to act swiftly, and to deal with the problem. And, of course, if the police don't deal with it or don't solve their problem, that can also cause a rift. So I think there's a few, strings to the bow there, Frank.
Yeah, you've covered a lot of ground there. Elizabeth, you're in Regina, Saskatchewan, where the prairie winds blow. And I expect that you would agree with some of what Mick has said, but do you have any different perspective or additional perspective based on your geography?
You know, there's a lot of talk in the news lately about diversity and inclusion, and I do think that there's a rift between police agencies and the communities that we serve, mainly because our communities have changed and diversified, and police services haven't changed fast enough to be truly representative of the communities we serve. We also haven't learned fast enough to truly understand the communities that we serve. The social and cultural makeup of our society is constantly changing. And as police, we need to ensure that we keep up with that change, both in terms of understanding it and being reflective of it. And I think that mismatch right there is a major cause of the rift between police and communities.
And you make a wonderful point there in that the community not only expects but wants their police service to reflect the community as a whole, but there's a natural sort of a conflict there in that, you know, policing isn't a simple profession for somebody to become part of. I mean, the requirements of the profession and the process of getting into the field are pretty stringent. And so when you say that they don't move swiftly enough, how much of that do you think is just simply the difficulty of adjusting the recruiting and hiring and training process? And how much of that is maybe some foot dragging?
I think a lot of it does play into the human resources aspect of it. We need to recruit more and I guess like open up the pipeline so that other diversified members of our communities know that there is a career option with police. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that policing historically in Canada anyways has been a white male dominated industry. And even the ways that we go about recruiting tend to target that group. When you think of like police officers are hockey coaches or football coaches. So then, you know, young men who grew up with those sports have, I guess, figures that they look up to that are law enforcement. And then that path is kind of opened up more to them. And then we also have other barriers that we have to work with. There's a natural or a historical distrust between our Indigenous communities and policing. Like when you think of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, back in the day when they were the Northwest Mounted Police, their role was to suppress Indigenous populations and to enforce attendance of residential schools. So we have hundreds of years of natural distrust that we have to break down as well if we want to recruit more diversity into our police services. And also there's other cultural aspects as well, like with the increased rate of immigration into Canada, we have populations who are coming to Canada from other countries that may not have had positive experiences with their police services in their own country. So now we have to build that relationship with them as well. So I don't think there's any foot dragging. It's just there are barriers that we have to work through and it's taking some time.
Yeah, it's more of a tanker than a speedboat, certainly, when it comes to that kind of change. And people are notoriously impatient. But it sounds to me like, from what you're saying, that the effort is being made and that tanker is turning, even if it doesn't have the turning radius of a speedboat.
Absolutely. All across Canada that I can speak to, we're seeing more and more police services focusing on having equity, diversity, and inclusion policies and practices and strategies that they are implementing throughout the organization, not just in the human resources side, but also just in leadership and the internally creating some cultural competence within their members as well.
Now, Larry, you have been in an upper leadership position. What's your take on this question?
You know, I think Mick and Elizabeth and you as well touched on various aspects of where community and policing are at odds with one another or this rift. And a lot of times in my opinion and in having conversations and with community and also having conversations with police, it's a lack of trust. And on the community's part, it's not about like trust that our police are stealing items or objects. It's that the police do or the communities do not trust that the police care to keep them safe, that there is this disconnect of community and police having these same objectives. Oftentimes, the community doesn't feel that the police share their same values. And when that happens, this rift is increased, especially then in times of conflict, based on the way that the community and the police develop relationships. And that lack of trust permeates to the policing side, where the police then don't trust that the community cares to be involved or be an active partner in this relationship. And I think that when we talk about how community and police partner, we oftentimes lose sight that it's the community's values that the police department should be supporting and not vice versa. You know, when we talk about legitimacy in policing, we're talking about the community giving the police the legitimate authority. We obviously have the power by law, but that legitimacy comes from the community. And I think at times our officers, our supervisors, our leaders, they just fail to realize that connection is impactful. And if there's not a concerted effort on part of the police department and we remain insular, then the community will also remain insular. And there has to be someone, an entity, a group of people willing to bridge that divide and sit down and have genuine conversations where we all remove our walls and we expose ourselves to some constructive criticism that will benefit both the community and the police.
Well, and you make a wonderful point there, but it also highlights one of the singular frustrations that I've had over the last decade or so, and that is the way that the police profession is frequently misunderstood by the public. And we can talk about why that is. You know, I'm sure that movies and popular fiction and you know, so forth has an impact on that. But from your perspective, you know, what are some of the things that the public may not know about the profession, particularly maybe the area that you were focused in? And just if you could sit down with someone that you didn't know who had a misunderstanding about police, which one would be the one you would want to correct because it's the most pervasive? Does anybody have any thoughts on this?
One of the biggest problems, I think, that or the, some of the biggest misunderstandings the public have, and especially in very busy police areas, is that they don't realise how thin the blue line actually is. You know, I think the public watch TV shows and they see the police station full of police, and someone rings the police and five or six police cars pull up with lights blaring in 2 or 3 minutes. In actual fact, I'm not quite sure in Larry's department, but in my old department, in a suburb of 20,000 people, we would put 2 patrol units out if we were lucky, and one on a night shift. So when the police, when the public ring for the police and they say, oh, look, we only live 10 minutes from the police station, they expect a 2 policemen who are eating donuts in the police station to jump in the car and drive down to their house and deal with the problem. They don't realise that those 2 police units might be carrying 15 or 20 jobs. And it's like a triage system in the hospital. The most serious of those cases will get dealt with first. Some of those jobs the police may never, ever get to because they're not serious enough, and the police have been diverted to other matters. And that, of course, creates fiction. Oh, the police don't care. I rang the police. They never did anything. They didn't arrive. And the other thing is, I think the public want their problem dealt with, and they want it dealt with then and there. Investigations can take a long time. And in some cases, the police can't deal with the problem because they don't have the power to do so. There's been no offence committed that the police can deal with. And then the public are unhappy that the police are lazy and so forth. So I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings that the public have about the police.
Yeah, I can recall going on a number of calls on night shift patrol and having the feeling that, you know, here at this call, they want me to solve in 10 minutes a problem that has been in the making for 10 years. And I don't have a magic wand. So,
Frank, I think, yeah, to follow up on Mick's point, like we as a society, we have relied on police to be the solve all to every problem. When you dial 911 for whatever issue, whether it's a quality of life complaint, whether it's a parking violation, too extreme as homicide, right? That we expect a response, and we expect our police officers to be equipped to handle the variety of issues in society. And to be quite honest, oftentimes our officers aren't trained in that manner. They're not equipped to handle or to be a psychologist or to be an addiction specialist. But in that moment, they're expected to have a level of expertise. And then add on top of that, we don't allow them or provide them the amount of time to be an adequate problem solver. So it often feels like to the community that they're getting this incomplete service. But the reality is the expectation versus the expertise aren't equal. And therefore, that we're doing police. And when I say we, I say police administrations, because I think it's a leadership issue and a leadership responsibility. We are doing our officers a disservice by not equipping them with the appropriate resources, whether appropriate resources, and we can talk about more resources later, and then not providing the community with the appropriate outcomes based on just that premise that our officers aren't given enough time for problem solving, and they're oftentimes ill-equipped to solve the problems they're being asked or challenged to fix.
That's a great point. It's really 2 great points, and I think we're going to touch on the first point here a little bit later, the resources and training piece. But that time available piece is so huge. I mean, I remember when I was the captain of patrol, we were hammered for calls. Guys and gals in patrol were always dealing with a stacked up screen and trying to get to them. And I told them, look, I would rather get a complaint from somebody that it took you way longer to get there to their lower profile call than they felt like they got poor service once you got there. My analogy was, let's not give them drive-through service. You know, let's make them wait at the door for sit-down service. And at least then they have a meal they're satisfied with. And if they had to wait, that's a frustration that's a lot easier to deal with than when you feel like you're inadequately served. But you probably encounter that problem in your role, Elizabeth. You're a civilian member of the police department and you work in the communications area. What perceptions about both civilians and communications and police in general do you wish the public had a better handle on?
Yeah, so my answer kind of ties into Mick's answer and Larry's as well. As the 911 communications manager, I would love to open up our doors and our phone lines to let the public see and hear what types of calls that we get, from the mundane calls to the nuisance calls to the life and death and traumatic ones. We get calls for everything. And as Larry said, we have become the social support of a first and last resort for society. And I guess another thing, like tying into that, is I would like people to know that police services consists of both civilian and sworn members. And yes, we are all highly trained and we came into this profession knowing that we would be held to a higher standard, but we are also human. And I see that misperception play out in the media a lot, where police officers seem, or the public seem to hold police officers and police employees to almost a superhuman standard, whereby when we make mistakes, we're judged harder. We make a bad choice, we are judged harder and more unrealistically. And likewise, we are offered less sympathy or support in times of loss or grief. Like, how many times have we seen comments such as, when an officer is killed in the line of duty, well, you know, he signed up for the job, he knew what he was getting into when he signed up for the job. Like, no one signs up to get killed in the line of duty. So I guess one of the things I would like the public to know as well is that police personnel, both civilian and sworn, are moral, skilled, dedicated, and experienced people, but also mere humans. And I think if the public can get that, I think we can, going back to the first question, heal the rift between police services and the communities as well.
That's very, very well said. And, you know, I think you make a great point in that it's perfectly acceptable to hold law enforcement personnel to a higher standard, but it is counterproductive to hold them to an impossible standard. You know, everybody comes to this profession for a particular reason. I'm kind of curious, what brought you to this profession? And Elizabeth, let's just go straight into that question with you, if you would. What brought you to this profession? And now that you've been part of it for a period of time, what do you still most admire about it? What keeps you in the profession?
So prior to joining this industry, if we want to call it that, I was in the corporate world. I'm a chartered professional accountant, and I worked in accounting firms prior to joining the police service. And I mean, it's a long story on why I joined the police service, but the reason I chose to join was, sounds cliche, it was to make a difference or to make an impact. And when you compare the corporate world and the police service world, it is night and day. I remember, you know, working in an accounting firm, getting these impossible deadlines from partners that just didn't make any sense. He wanted this report done by Friday, which meant I would have to work all night on it for no reason. But now that I'm in the policing world, when there is a deadline or when there is a project, there is a public safety, public service, and sometimes even officer safety reason behind the successful completion of whatever project it is. And that meaningfulness in my work is the reason that I joined it, and I'm, you know, sticking with it, and that I admire the most. And at the risk of sounding cliche, but the people, you know, we talk about the blue family and police family and things like that. But I think you don't really truly understand it until you join the policing world. There's nothing more than leading a team of men and women in my communication center and doing what I can as a manager for them, knowing that their job is serving the public, and I want to make it as easy for them as possible to do that calling. And there's just a huge purpose that I find in that.
And you, you're married to a Regina police officer, correct?
I am. Yeah. My husband is a patrol officer. He's also on the SWAT team here at the Regina Police Service, and he's been a member for, I think, 8 or 9 years now.
So you have that perspective of a civilian member who works with law enforcement, but then you also probably get a little bit of that view from the member, you know, from the commission member, because you share a home with him.
Yes, absolutely. And there's been many dinner table discussions and debates, obviously, about policing from the civilian side and the sworn side, but also just the conflict between the internal conflict sometimes between police officers and management as well. There's a lot of discuss when you have that type of dynamic in the family.
I imagine there is. Larry, same question to you. What brought you to join law enforcement? And now that you've been in that career for a period of time, what do you still admire about the profession the most?
You know, Elizabeth talks about cliche, but I think when you talk to any officer, they tell you it's their ability to help people. I'm a big people person. I enjoy human interaction, and I need and want to be around people, right? So I was going to be in some service industry in some way. I admire law enforcement from the time I was a kid, that it is a profession that you can be involved with people on an everyday basis, and that it's maybe the most dynamic career choice anybody could ever choose. The things that we do on a daily and nightly basis, day in, day out, are oftentimes never duplicated, right? It's the adrenaline that comes from the hot call. It's the emotion that comes from a domestic violence call. It's the sheer joy you see in a kid's face when you have the ability to have a positive impact in their life. You have the ability to touch someone's life every day in a positive way. And oftentimes there will be some negative consequences to that. But if you focus on the positives, we have the ability to have an impact and influence the lives of communities every day, the communities that we actually grow up and live in, and make it a safer place for everybody to live, our kids, our family members, our friends, people we don't even know. And then maybe that kind of parlays into the second part. What I admire about this profession is the nobility that we have men and women that are willing to sacrifice their lives for people they have never met and stay committed in a time where society may not be as thankful or expressive and supportive as we need or expect them to be. But our officers are as committed and engaged and involved as they've ever been in a time in life where maybe that feedback loop isn't so supportive or positive. And that nobility of sacrifice will always remain within me and my admiration for policing professionals today and those that choose to come into profession in the future will never wane.
Yeah, there's some nobility to making the right call because it's the right call, even if the hometown fans are booing you for it. A little double entendre there for you, Larry.
Exactly.
Now, Mick, you had a 40-year career in law enforcement. So I'm curious what brought you to the service, why you joined, and when you got to the end of your career and looked back, what did you still admire about the profession?
Well, Frank, I've been asked hundreds of times, why did I join? And I struggle to answer that question. Larry summed it up pretty well. As a kid, I had an immense respect for the local police. My father used to play cricket with a couple of the fellas. I got to know them quite well. I think what really turned me was when I was about 14, I was with my father, and one thing led to another, and three people attacked my father and gave him a decent belting and hospitalised him. And I saw the police investigation and the compassion and the way they handled that, and I thought, this is for me. So, and also in the early 70s, when you left school, everyone got a job. There was no unemployment in those days. So you either worked for a bank or you joined the military, and I chose to join the police force. And I suppose when I sum it up, my whole entire life was involved in it. I joined at age 17 as a police cadet, like an apprentice for 2 years. And we mentioned like the brotherhood, the friends you meet, the experiences you have, support you get. But the variation, you don't. There's probably, I think, something like 300 different positions in the Victoria Police. There's maybe more, and they're all available to you, whether you're male, female, or doesn't matter who or what you are. You can be what you want to be. I think that's an old U.S. Army slogan, I think, but it's true. And I just lived for the job. I loved it. And as I got older, I slowed up a bit, I suppose, but. In 40 years, I never really got tired of going to work. And I often used to say the day I do get tired about and not wanting to go to work is the day that I won't go. And that's what happened. So really, I don't really know why I joined, but I think Larry summed it up quite well.
Well, and I think it's interesting that when Elizabeth was talking earlier about paths to law enforcement and role models essentially being one path. If people see law enforcement officers as in their lives and their role models to them, that makes them feel like that's a path open to them. And you mentioned the cricket players, and I think that's a good demonstration of exactly that concept that she was driving at. I do think there's a lot to admire about this profession. Certainly, I would echo what all three of you have said, aspects of it. Every cop you ever met, they get in that oral board and they get asked, why do you want to be a police officer? And to help people is the number one answer. And having sat on many of those boards, you know, you try to delve a little deeper and find out what that means. But I think it's a genuine sentiment, which I guess brings me to the next topic, which is a little bit dissonant with regard to that. And that is misconduct. Or perceived misconduct. And I don't think anybody would argue that there hasn't been a lot of high-profile police misconduct cases that have cropped up in the news over the past decade. I mean, at least in my experience, we could go all the way back to the Rodney King event. Certainly was a watershed event in U.S. policing. But they've been all over, certainly the United States, and recently, of course, the George Floyd incident really was another watershed moment. And many of those misconducts, they seem to have overtones, or not even overtones, just flat out a component of racism, which especially here in the United States, I think is something we struggle with. So I guess I'd like to start the conversation by asking you, since you're in this profession and you kind of know what goes on behind the curtain and the whys and wherefores of things, how have you reacted to these incidents in general, or any one of the ones that has specifically, you know, really affected you and caused a reaction? What was that incident and what was that reaction?
You know, Frank, with recency, I look at George Floyd and that tragedy of that day in Minneapolis, and I know people think and immediately go to racism or racist cops as the default for behavior such as that, or that aberrant behavior such as that. And in that instance, what it showed to me is that our profession has become just indifferent. I think of when I look at that scenario, the diversity of officers in that event, it was multicultural. There was Asian American, there was a Black officer and a white officer, and race didn't seem to stop the death of George Floyd, and indifference caused it. They just seemed like the officers in that instance did not care. They didn't care for another human being. They didn't care for the sanctity of life, and that affected me probably more than any of those other events, albeit every one of them tragic, is that on national television, the things that we say we get into this profession to do, to help people, that we failed at the most basic fundamental of our profession. And that goes into empathy that our officers have for our communities, or the lack thereof. And I think we need to get back to that humanistic approach in training and education from the start, and constantly reinforce what our human expectations are for our officers, not just our policy expectations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does to me. But you and I are the U.S. contingent of this conversation. So I think we might be the guiltier nation where racism is a component. I'm curious if Elizabeth or Mick see the U.S. in that same way and what their experience is in either Canada or down under.
I think speaking from an Australian perspective, looking from the outside into the U.S., I think that there seems to me to be terrible racial divide in the US. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen here in Australia either. A third of the population of Australia as we speak at the moment was born overseas. We have a large ethnic population here of various races. And we have suburbs with large pockets of various people. Now, for example, the suburb I live in, we have a lot of Australian Vietnamese and we have a lot of Indians. But there's the odd flare up, but from the main point of view, we get on very well together. But I think the thing is, what struck me with that George Floyd video is that Larry's spot on. I don't think they cared. Wouldn't you have thought that one of those other officers standing there would have said to the officer kneeling on the bloke, said, hey, you know, what's going on? You don't need to, just sit him up. He'll be all right. They didn't do that. And I think that's a problem. You've got to pull up people for their behaviour. I can give you an example where one of the stations I was at, there was an Indigenous fellow, an Aboriginal fellow, great bloke. And there was two of the older patrol officers were always telling Aboriginal jokes, and you could see he didn't like it. So I got him aside and said, why aren't you, objecting to this? He said, oh, because I want to fit in. And so I got the two other fellas aside and had a go at them. They kept doing it because they thought they were funny, but they weren't. We have to pull people up for their behaviour. It's as simple as that. Getting back to race, look, there's racists in Australia. There's racist police, but I don't think it's as entrenched as it seems to be in the US.
And from a Canadian perspective, we have a racial divide too, and specifically in Saskatchewan, our racial divide is between the police services and our Indigenous community. With reference to the George Floyd incident, I think most police services in Canada, when we watch that tragic incident, we realize that our use of force model and our use of force oversight is a little bit more stringent than the US. So we'd like to think that it would never happen here, but that doesn't mean that this shouldn't open up uncomfortable and critical reflection and discussion in all police services across the world. After that George Floyd incident, we saw a movement of defund the police all across the world. But that defund the police movement, I feel, is another symptom of the cancel culture that is so prevalent in today's society. When a celebrity says or does something wrong, you know, they're fired, they're canceled, they're ostracized. When one police officer in one country does something wrong, it's defund the police all across the nation. So this cancel culture and this defund the police movement robs us of the chance to educate each other and learn from each other and to remediate wrong behavior and grow as a society. I think when there is a mistake or a tragic incident relating to police misconduct or duties, instead of taking the easy route of canceling or defunding police, which would satisfy some of the public's thirst for immediate action, I think it's time to have the uncomfortable, the legitimate, and the critical discussion of defining police. Why and how did police become the social support of first and last resort for society's marginalized citizens? And I say that it will become an uncomfortable discussion because I think it'll call into question other partner institutions in our society, such as social services, healthcare, education, and where they have failed some of our citizens and how police, I guess, have found ourselves in the situation where we are the ones called to solve every problem and are put into situations that we shouldn't be a part of.
And I think even when you think about misconduct as in our profession, for such a long time, for historically in law enforcement, especially in the United States, we have been so insular in the police, investigating police, and resistant to civilian oversight and civilian input into our disciplinary processes that the communities don't believe that we can effectively do it on our own. So it's incumbent on police administrations in the 21st century to include and welcome community input and oversight in the manner in which we adjudicate discipline and handle misconduct complaints. That I believe will give the community a sense of ease that if we're involved and we get to pull back the curtain, we then can attest and affirm that the organizations are holding their officers accountable to the values of the community. And until we do that, I think we're always going to face this challenge that the police cannot be trusted to police their own and hold each other accountable.
I guess I have no time for people when they are extreme in their views. And certainly to say that when one police officer, as Elizabeth mentioned, one police officer does something and maybe that person is corrupt, maybe that person is racist, certainly what they did is absolutely wrong. But then the entire profession gets painted with a brush of the same shade. That sticks in my craw because my own experience has been that the overwhelming number of police officers and police professionals in the agency I worked in, and then in my experiences traveling all over the U.S. and Canada, teaching leadership, has been that they are hardworking, dedicated people who are trying to do the right thing. And so I guess just before we go any further, is everybody on that same boat? Does everybody feel the same way about the profession?
Absolutely. I just don't think we are not inclusive enough as an organization with our communities. And I think that failure, it goes maybe back to the very first question, that failure of inclusion, that failure for an organization to be receptive to outside influences and input creates this barrier and will always be an obstacle to trust. But our profession, you're right. Like Frank, I see it, like Elizabeth sees it, like Mick sees it, that our officers and the people that dedicate their selves to this profession, they care. And they care most when they care even more when we're embarrassed by the actions of a few. But it doesn't get the same level of attention. And it's not sensationalized on a daily basis. So it just becomes background noise that the acts of our officers on a daily basis are noble and just and in accordance with our community expectations. And these outliers, we'll hold them responsible and we should hold them responsible. And all good cops want to hold them responsible.
And just, you know, let's just get that out here that there is systemic racism in policing. Policing is an institution, just like healthcare, just like education, and there are disparate impacts on different cultures.
But that doesn't mean that the members of that profession are racist. It means that the institution itself is. Okay.
Exactly. And I mean, it's undeniable and inevitable that there would be systemic racism in our institutions when these institutions were created hundreds of years ago. So as we move into the new, generation, into the new era, we do have to work hard to dismantle those systemic racist pieces in our institution. But you're right, not all individual members of not all police officers are racist, just like not all teachers are racist just because they work in the education system, or all doctors are racist because they work in the healthcare system. But unfortunately, policing is that one career where just because of the institution we work in, we are painted and attributed with as being racist, and especially with incidents and misconduct incidents being portrayed in the media or thrown in the media as they rightly should be. But at the same time, it has individual impacts on the members in our profession. And if we were to jump back to the topic earlier too, the public needs to be aware that police officers are sometimes subject to third party racial profiling. When we receive a call from the public, sometimes the information that is given to us is given in a way that is not impartial. So when we respond, I guess we are subject to that bias, and it is a hurdle for us to overcome in how do we respond in a partial way and enforce the law in a partial way, even though the initial call for service that came to us may have had some racial bias to it from the public's perspective.
Yeah, I think you're making a great point there. And I guess one of the things that comes up, I think, in law enforcement is much like maybe like an emergency room in the healthcare field, the stakes are high. I mean, we get called in for some low stakes stuff, but as a profession, generally, we're dealing with things where stakes are high. Crisis is going on, either at a very micro level or at a meta level when you're talking about civil unrest or whatever. And one of the things that might demonstrate to a community how well their law enforcement agency is performing is just to look at the total number of calls for service or human contacts that an agency makes over the course of a year, and what percentage of those are favorable versus unfavorable versus even claimed misconduct. And so real quickly, just so we can see the diversity, or maybe we can see the sameness, I'm not sure what the answer will be here, but at your agency, what would those percentages or numbers look like? And Elizabeth, since you were addressing this, maybe you could go first.
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but calls for service, we average about 70,000 calls for service a year. So those are interactions, though, where, you know, the public has actually called us and we attended. So that's just a fraction, I would say, of other interactions and positive interactions that we've had in our community. I'd have to dig up the misconduct or public complaint numbers, but I can tell you it's a fraction of that.
Yeah, I mean, when you say a fraction, would you say, you know, 5%, 1%, a fraction of 1%? Where would you ballpark it? I'm sorry, you're Canadian. Where would you, which side of the blue line would that be on?
So if I'm saying 70,000 calls for service a year and 1% being, did I do that math right? Hold on. 70,000 and 1% being 700 incidents, I'm going to say it's going to be less than 1% of our calls for service end up being legitimate, verified, substantiated public complaints.
And that could range from an officer was rude, or they didn't like the job that she did, or all the way up to, you know, some more serious misconducts, but they're all lumped together usually in those kinds of polls.
Yeah, Frank, could I step in there? I'm like Liz, I haven't got the exact figures, but it's absolutely minute. If you look at the amount of police contacts and how many complaints come out of it, it's absolutely minute. And what you have to dig down to is what you just said, Frank. What sort of complaints are they? Now, in my 40, I don't know if we're at the stage now to talk about corruption in the force, but in my 40 years in the job, I especially once I become a station commander and later on a local area commander, most of the problems I dealt with were the ones you just talked about, Frank. Over the years, I've seen stupid members, I've seen immature officers, I've seen officers making bad decisions, I've seen officers who are very inadequate human beings until they put the uniform on and they get a sense of power, that sort of thing. But major corruption, criminal misconduct or malfeasance, I've seen very little. And that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It does. But at my level of patrol, we weren't exposed to high-level crimes and criminals. The higher-end crimes, like the Major Crime Squad, the Armed Robbery Squad, the Vice Squad, well, we don't have one now, but we did in the past, and the Drug Squad have always been high-risk areas, and there have been very serious incidents of corruption there. So I think getting back to what we're saying is that a lot of members are just, they just don't think. They don't think of the consequences. And I can give you a lot of examples if you would like. I also did a 6 month secondment to our internal affairs section. We were dealing with unlawful dissemination of police information from our police computer systems, and it would raise the hair on the back of your head, some of the things that went on there. But overall, I agree with Liz that it is a minute amount of people that get into trouble. And don't forget, too, a lot of these complaints are frivolous. I can give you an example where I took a telephone call and the person wanted to make a complaint, and we got halfway through the telephone conversation before he realised that I was the person he was making the complaint about. And I can tell you, any similarity between what he was telling me and what actually happened was coincidental.
Well, now, Larry, you were an assistant chief at a large Eastern Police Department, so I know you had to at least be aware of what that ratio would have been at your agency.
When I left, it's statistically, we had 250,000 calls for service in 2018. Of that, just shy of 10,000 physical arrest, and of that, less than 1% resulted in any type of force. And of that, of all those 250,000 police contacts, we had less than 150 complaints against our officers and 12 filed lawsuits. So the numbers in every instance are going to be less than 1%. The expectation, and understandably so, when you spoke to it when we started the segment, that policing is always going to be held to a higher standard because of the dynamic nature and power that the profession has. This, when I talk about it, I think of the only profession that has the ability to take away your freedom and also take away your life without consult to any other entity in the moment, right? And because of the ability to take away freedom and life, that we will always hold those officers, our officers, the profession, to a higher standard than any other that we name. But the reality of it is that our officers on a daily basis, I'm certain this isn't just specific to Pittsburgh, that you can look at department after department across the country, coast to coast, and you will see similar numbers. There are very few instances of misconduct relative to the amount of calls for service and interactions that our officers have nationally.
But those misconducts, when they do occur, are pretty high profile because of the nature of the job, because of the expectations. And I'd like to circle back to something I think it was Elizabeth has said earlier, and both of you and Mick have also alluded to, and that is, yeah, we hold the officers to this high standard, and we give them this incredible authority to accomplish what we're asking them to do. But maybe what we're asking them to do is a little bit more than we should be. In other words, historically, at least in the U.S., as services from the society that we live in have been curtailed, the need for those services hasn't gone away. And so the responsibility to address the symptoms that come with those needs not being met has fallen to the police. And so while that might sound a little bit vague, I'll throw out an example that I know we're all familiar with, and that would be, for instance, mental health services. When mental health services are cut, the need for people with mental health issues to get those services doesn't go away, but the responsibility to deal with the symptoms that come with that end up inevitably falling to the police. And as someone said earlier, we may not be, as individual officers or collectively as an agency, we may not be trained sufficiently enough to deal with those issues in a way that ensures the best possible outcome. So I guess what I'm saying is we keep putting things on law enforcement's plate, and inevitably, maybe that's what defund the police needs to mean or needs to drive, is a solution that involves parceling out the responsibilities where they need to go. Now, am I just whistling past the graveyard here, or does anyone have some thoughts on this?
I agree wholeheartedly with you, Frank, that when we talk about defund, I talk about reimagining, and that, you know, these budget cuts across social services now become the responsibility of the police, who are ill-prepared, ill-equipped, and ill-trained to manage a mental health crisis or an addiction issue or a domestic violence, long-term domestic violence abuse situation, but society continues to put that expectation on the profession with an unreasonable expectation of success. And I say that to say, like, we're not getting, the police aren't getting any better trained in the amount of time that we have them in the academy, yet we are continually being challenged with problems that we don't have solutions for, and that communities, its cities, should start considering other types of responses that, and I'm not certain the budget needs to be, or the cost of it needs to be removed from the police budget, because there are still police deficiencies that budget will address, whether it's additional training, whether it's additional officers, et cetera, but that there should be a focus on co-responder programs, that we are sending the appropriately trained person to that specific crisis and not relying on police to solve problems they're ill-equipped to handle.
So there's a solution, one solution to this. Are there others? I mean, what are some of the solutions? We talked about this rift early on. We described it. We defined it. We talked about the misunderstandings. What are some of these solutions that we can do in any capacity, whether as an individual police officer or member, or what we can do as an agency, profession-wide? What's happening in your agency or in your career maybe that is a good example of this?
Well, at the Regina Police Service, we do have that corresponding model that Larry was talking about. We do have our PACT teams, or our police and crisis teams. So a police officer is partnered up with a mental health worker, and they attend as a unit to any calls for service that involve a person suffering from mental health problems. And I can,
Elizabeth, what's the division of labor then, or what's the role? Who takes on what role in a scenario like that?
So they're paired up, like they're actually a partnership, as if it was you and a fellow police officer attending a call. So they ride in the same vehicle. I don't know exactly what happens when they get to the call, but you have two individually trained members in two different things. So if there was a violence or a weapons offense involved, you have a trained police officer. But if it's a mental health issue that requires, you know, some de-escalation, some communication skills that the police officer may have, the mental health worker has that. So now you come as a more qualified and fully trained unit to attend to these types of calls. And I can tell you that they're fully utilized, and we could use more of them. But, you know, funding is always an issue. It's a partnership with the health institution for the mental health worker side of things. So the corresponding work, but everyone needs to get on board. So when we talk about what can we do to resolve this rift in the community, I don't think police agencies can solve it on their own. We need our other partner agencies in society to step up and work with us on a collaborative solution. These are society's problems. So every institution in society has to show up.
And you're talking about having those different institutions each basically play to their strengths.
Absolutely. Whether it's housing or mental health or social services, or like Larry had mentioned, you know, long-term domestic violence supports, everyone has to show up and, yeah, play to their strengths to help out these marginalized members of our society.
I found that if all we do is send the police to complex situations, all you get is a simple short-term solution, because that's all that they have the resources to do. Whereas if you involve other agencies like you're talking about, you can solve the root cause of the problem, or the deeper problem, rather than just the symptom.
Yeah, and you know, and I think that's why the word defund really gets my goat sometimes, because it does get police defensive when you talk about defunding the police, when the actual term should be, you know, redefining police, or let's define police better. And when in reality, I think most police agencies would be okay with reallocated funding if it also meant reallocated workload.
Do you think that's true in the Australian front there, Mick?
Yeah, we have pretty well the same system as Liz was describing. If we get a mental health issue, or a drug overdose, or some problem like that, the normal patrol car will respond, and then we have what's known as the CAT team, crisis assessment team. Now, when they first started it up, they were health practitioners, but as soon as you mentioned violence, alcohol, or drugs, they wouldn't come. are ineffective. Most mental health issues that draw the attention of the police have got those three things attached to them. So now we have the same as Liz described, as we have a police officer and a mental health practitioner on the unit. And they, once the problem has settled down, they take it from there. But the problem you've got worldwide, Frank, is that the police are the only organisation that are available 24 hours a day, and we're free. So, you know, if your car breaks down, you call a tow truck, it's going to cost you money, so you don't call it, but you call the police. The other issue is that these defunding problems, they're blocking, like, ambulances. Most of their calls now, or not most, but a disturbing amount of non-injuries, their mental health issues, and the hospital emergency wards are full up with people who have got problems that shouldn't be in hospitals. So, yeah, defund the police, but take some of our workload off us if they do that.
Yeah, I certainly have no issue with slapping a Band-Aid on a problem that can't be solved that night, but you can't just continue to go slap a Band-Aid on arterial spray and expect that wound to be taken care of. So I think you both make a great point. Larry, here in the United States, there seems to be some resistance at times in law enforcement to these kinds of changes because it kind of clashes with that warrior mindset that is prevalent. What's your take on that?
I would agree. The way that we have historically taught our officers in the United States is that they are warriors. What they're at war with, I'm not certain, but we have created a war environment in their training, and it's relative to life and death and going home at the end of your shift. And we haven't talked about being guardians of society until recently, within the last 5 or so years, that even became a concept in policing. And our role in a guardian mindset is much different than our role as a warrior. And moving and our officers' training and education toward that type of thought process, hiring officers with that type of attitude and behavior characteristics will, I think, over time, maybe back to some of these points, none of this has happened in an instant. These have been behaviors and patterns that have developed over the course of decades, a century. And it will take us time to move our officers, as move our profession as a collective, into the guardian mindset and not warriors. That it's okay to punt. It's okay that you don't have to win in this very moment, especially in instances that aren't life and death. And I think as we move in that direction as a profession, as the future leaders of our profession that believe in those concepts of guardianship take roles in organizations across America, we'll see that style of policing, we'll see that style of empathy and care translate through the rank and file.
And to be clear, I don't think anyone, at least anyone who's ever had anything to do with real law enforcement and seen what goes on and what the requirements of the job are, is advocating for people who aren't capable of being a warrior at the appropriate moment. It's more about what your default state of mind is. And if that's guardianship with the ability to, oh, now I have to engage, and this requires a warrior mindset, so I need to apply that. It's not an either-or proposition. It's having both tools on your tool belt. At least that's what I'm talking about. I think that's what you're saying as well, right?
I believe in the philosophy of do no harm. And that applies to every facet of law enforcement. Our main objective should be to do no harm. Yet we have an expectation that in situations that are life and death, that our officers can be and are prepared and trained to be a warrior in that event. But those events are so far and few between. They're almost similar to the events of misconduct. They're so far and few between. They're the exception and not the rule. And we're teaching to the exception. We're and that's in our philosophy for historically has been toward the exception and not the rule. And I think that's got to be the fundamental change.
And nobody's talking about having a lack of vigilance or anything like that. We're just talking about a shift in the approach. Mick and Liz, is this warrior mindset, is that a component of the police mindset in Australia and Canada?
Look, in Australia, it is to a certain extent. There are times, as Larry alluded to, is that the police have to win. If the police don't win, well, what's going to happen to society? But it's not in every situation. So you have to be able to work out, I've got to win this particular encounter, or look, it doesn't matter if I go away and come back and fight another day. But balanced with that as well, Frank, is that the public sometimes can have a perception that the police force is soft. Now, I know we've got a big problem with youth crime in certain areas of this country, and the police forces are being accused of being soft. The public are sick of victimisation. So it has to be balanced with that. But overall, if you can't take control of a situation and make someone do something that he doesn't want to do, then you probably shouldn't be in the police force. But if you think you've got to do that every time, you probably shouldn't be in the police force either.
That's an excellent rule.
In Regina, the warrior mindset isn't something that I've heard in our service at all. Our values at the Regina Police Service are a respectful professional service, and that's what we see our police officers doing every day. However, with the advent of social media and cell phone cameras, the incidents that are captured on camera and shown are the ones where maybe that warrior mindset has come out of necessity. When I think of the thousands of interactions that Regina police officers have with our community, the majority of them are done peacefully and in a relationship building way. But these interactions, you know, don't make the highlight reel. When I think about the training that our police members receive, there's more and more emphasis on verbal judo and de-escalation techniques. But no one's going to film that. Like, no one's going to film a police officer standing in the middle of the street talking and de-escalating a situation for 20 minutes. They're going to film the ones that have some use of force. And use of force, by its very nature, is ugly. And that's what gets shown in the media and in social media. And that's what people want. That's what the public wants to see, right? They want to click on the video, watch the video, see the dirty and ugly use of force, and then make an opinion on the video. And unfortunately, that's the type of interactions that get magnified in our police service, and they're just a minor fraction of the thousands of interactions that we have a day.
Well, and that point that you make, that the use of force is ugly, it's ugly whether it's legitimate or not. I mean, certainly if you look at it, something that you know is wrong, they're not supposed to be using force, or the force is excessive, that makes it even worse. But even a absolutely lawful and legitimate and completely necessary use of force can be ugly to look at. And it seems like, you know, sometimes people want to jump to conclusions about it, and other times it's just their reaction, ooh, that's ugly, and then the officer gets blamed because it's ugly, even if it's legitimate. And I guess that's something I think the public could do to help solve this rift, is just be willing to be more informed and to hear some of the things like what you just said, and to be open to those possibilities.
Oh, Frank, I was just going to say, Liz is spot on. I'll give you a recent example in our suburb where a fellow, really well known to the local police, drove his car home. He hasn't got a driver's license and he was speeding. So the local patrol unit pulled him over. And of course, when he got out, he wanted to take the police on. He was just absolutely abusive, just acting up completely. And of course, the neighbors come out, people started to film, the backup unit arrived, there was confrontation. And then the supervising sergeant, who I know very well, appeared and said, okay, let's all get in our cars and go. And they said, well, why? Aren't we going to do anything? I said, well, we know who he is. We know where he lives. Why cause a confrontation in front of all these people and end up on Facebook and a complaint? Let's come back around at 6 o'clock in the morning and serve all the paperwork on him then. Great policing in my mind. They've won the battle without all the hoo-ha.
Yeah, that's a veteran move right there. And I think it goes back to that, if it's not critical that I win, then what's my best approach sort of question. And that ties really nicely into what I'd like to touch on here on the home stretch for this episode. And that is, you know, we've touched on what an agency might be able to do to bridge this gap. And it sounds to me, and please chime in if I'm oversimplifying things, it sounds to me like one of the best solutions is to collaborate and cooperate with other agencies within the institution, whether you're talking about municipal level or whatever level, so that everybody can play to their strengths and bring their particular skills to bear on the problem. The example that we used here today obviously had to do with mental health organizations working with the police to address folks that have those issues. So that's what an agency can do. And of course, that I think that would apply to a lot of different problems and a lot of different other institutions and agencies that don't all have to necessarily be other municipal agencies too. You could reach into the community for community-based organizations to accomplish that. At a professional level, you know, we're talking nationally and internationally even. I think if we continue to train and hold people accountable and make people aware, that's going to help bridge that gap. But where big change tends to happen is at the individual level. And so I guess my question for you here as we roll into the last bit of this episode is, what can an individual police officer or civilian member of an agency do, and maybe specifically to where you served or are serving, to help bridge this gap, to help overcome this rift that we've been talking about?
Frank, I've got a bit of input here for you. I can call back, recall back in the mid-90s, I was the station commander at an inner suburban police station. We had a very, very high population of recent migrants to the country. Mainly Australian Vietnamese, Africans, and South Americans who were refugees. Now, what was happening? There was a lot of problems between the local police and these groups. There were a lot of what we call housing commission areas, like housing projects. I think you'd call them in the US, high level, 20 stories high. A lot of people fitted into a small area. Now, the police patrol unit would drive in and a television would come over the edge and land there. It was terrible. So what happened? Some bright spark got the idea, oh, we'll set up a community liaison. Now, it failed miserably because the problem was the people doing the liaison was the deputy chief of our area, and he'd come down and he'd speak to the elders of the Vietnamese community, and they'd have a cup of coffee together and shake hands and get a photo taken and go in the newspaper. And they'd say, oh, we've got no problems here whatsoever. But the problem with that was that the deputy chief wasn't driving the patrol car through those flats at 2 o'clock in the morning. And the head of the leaders of the communities weren't in the group of 20 or 30 people throwing stones at the police car. So it didn't work. So what I did was that I gave the problem to the people who were part of the problem. So I devolved it down to a patrol level, and I allocated each patrol unit to go and speak to the people and say, why are you throwing stones at us? And they'd say, because you harass us all the time. You know, it started off a bit confrontational, but by about 3 months, it worked quite well. So the idea with liaison is to get it down to ground level. It's all airy, fairy and pie in the sky if you think the deputy chief's going to solve the problem by having a cup of tea with the local imam of the Muslim community or whatever.
So you're talking about the human connection there, and things happening at the where the rubber meets the road, right? Where the line officers and line members are doing the heavy lifting of law enforcement. Elizabeth,
I think we can do as an agency and as individuals is we need to tell our story. So knowing that the media and the public tend to share stories about, you know, SWAT teams, tear gas, use of force and misconduct, we need to make an effort to share all the other stories, the human side of stories, the relationship building, the peaceful resolutions. We also need to share the stories that the impact of this work has on our members. And we're beginning to see that now with you know, a lot of focus and emphasis on the mental health of police officers. And, you know, there's a reason why, because for so long, police officers have just done their jobs and compartmentalized it and never shared it and never shared how it affected them mentally because of that warrior mentality and the fear of appearing weak. So I think now that stigma is beginning to be eroded and we begin to share the stories that we have as individuals, as families of police officers, we can begin to connect more with our community. And even as an individual, I don't know how many times you see a friend or a neighbor make a comment on social media or share something that isn't actually right. And I would just scroll past because I just didn't have the effort I didn't have the energy, I guess, to have that uncomfortable discussion when, you know what, that's how you educate people is like have those uncomfortable discussions, have some, you know, critical analysis, see why they shared what they shared, show them your side of the story, but it will take some effort. And I think just in general, we need to share our stories more.
It's a great example. Larry, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think we need to work to humanize the profession. And I say that all relationships, whether it's your dating relationship, your friendships, your professional relationship, they're all built on trust. And back to the very first thing I said when we started this conversation, that trust is something that takes time to build and take more importantly than time, it takes effort. So we have to press upon our officers that it's a personal responsibility for every one of our personnel to make and build relationships with the community when given the opportunity to be human, to do so and take away the stigma that officers are robotic and that officers lack sympathy and empathy and make the profession human. And to do that, I think it takes commitment and direction from leadership to allow our officers that time and space to build those relationships. And I'm not sure if Mick or Elizabeth said it, but get away from that. You may even said it. Get away from that drive-by policing, reactive policing model that we have become so accustomed to. And go back to in history when you think about Sir Robert Peel and principles of policing, that the community of the police are the community, and this is a partnership. And if we build it together based on human relations, that when crises occur, we will have a better level of understanding about each other. We will have a better level of trust. We will have built that community goodwill in advance. And that's an effort that is worthwhile undertaking that I think we miss as a profession based on the style and type of policing we've come to expect.
Yeah, I think the introduction of the automobile to policing has probably been both the best and worst thing that could have happened. I mean, it certainly made us able to respond to more calls more quickly, but it also put such a barrier between the police and the public and started that process that literally, I think, has been happening since then and is only now being a little bit broken down. But it is a two-way street. There's a person on each side of that wall or that rift. And so the last question I want to ask you is, if a member of the public who, you know, came to you with an open mind, somebody you maybe knew or who trusted you, if they asked you, what can I do to help heal this rift? What can I do from my side of it to make things better? You know, what would you tell them? What can a member of the public do?
I tell them to be an ambassador. When the officers and the police or the police and community relationships are satisfactory, are exceptional in some cases, the community doesn't speak out for the organization in times of crises. They become silent, and which then allows those voices to be amplified that are critical. And it creates an environment for police officers that no one supports the good things that we do. And I think in any communities, whether it be in the affluent communities that have been marginalized by policing, all of these communities have positive relationships with police. However, when crises occur, those relationships and those interactions seem to be be silenced by the event. And then I think it's important to have, even in crises, to be able to show the support, to be able to show the efforts of that relationship building for all to heal, the community and the police.
What could someone in Regina do, Elizabeth?
I wholeheartedly agree with what Larry just said, but I also recognize that it is sometimes really hard for individuals to be ambassadors of police because of that cancel culture that I referenced earlier. They fear retribution if they were to share a positive impression of police in a public forum or online. So knowing that, I would just say, if you can't be a positive ambassador of police, or you are hesitant to share your thoughts on a public forum, then at minimum, just try to be impartial in what stories you like and share on social media. Don't just share the sensationalized ones that paint police in a negative picture, but make sure that you also share the positive ones. There are positive stories out there, but they definitely don't get the spotlight that the negative ones get.
No, and we could probably do a better job as the agency and as a profession to share those positive stories as well. We're just usually running from call to call and don't have the time to do it. But how about down under, Mick?
Frank, I think Larry and Elizabeth have been reading my notes. They've said everything I wanted to say, really. But look, overall, Australians get on pretty well with the police. Ron, Australia was founded as a penal colony, so there's always been a little bit of mistrust of authority. But and jokingly, my American friend at immigration, they asked him, did he have any prior criminal convictions? And he said, I didn't think we needed any anymore to come into Australia. What I would say to people is support your police. If you see a crime and you don't want to get involved in it, at least ring up, you know, ring up anonymously. The other thing I would say is try and get the facts. We've got too many backyard lawyers in this country and probably over there, and we see far too many video snips of an incident that took half an hour, but we see the 20 seconds where the police actually push the man to the ground or grab him by the hair or something like that. And so I just say to people, get the facts, keep an open mind, and ditto Larry and Elizabeth.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here, and I think we've done a little more than skip a stone across a very deep lake, but it is a very deep lake, so there's quite a bit that we may not have touched on. Before we go, though, I wanted to give each of you an opportunity to just offer your final thoughts on the topic, anything that you want to touch on, any personal insights you might have on this subject, how it's affected you, or just what you think about it. And so since I'm coming from North America, let's give the guy down under the first go.
Frank, I've enjoyed the comments today. It's been great to get a perspective from people from different countries. Look, I think in closing, I'd just like to say that I think if we look at police as humans, part of the community, I think we'd probably get on a lot better together. But no, I can't think of much more to say. I think we've had a pretty good discussion.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Final thoughts, Larry?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. So thank you all for allowing me to be a part. You know, at the end of the day, I think this truly is a defining moment in policing. It's a movement that will impact this profession for decades to come. And it will require the commitment of everyone. And when I say everyone, I mean police leadership, rank and file officers, and community to come together to build true partnerships and relationships. And the law enforcement community relies on the community's support for its legitimacy, the community's support for its authority. And we should all be working together to create a partnership that is inclusive and builds upon trust to ensure that whenever there are crises that occur, that relationship sustains those crises. And that will take the effort and commitment of everyone involved. And that will require long-term investment in solutions, and instead of pointing fingers about who's to blame for the problem. So I think if we can get there, if we can start to have those conversations, those critical, open and honest, vulnerable conversations, that I know the profession is ready for those conversations. And I know the community wants those conversations. So we have to build that bridge to bring them all together.
Well put. Final thoughts, Elizabeth?
Oh, once again, like, I could talk about this for hours, and thank you, Frank, for giving me the opportunity to be on this panel. Just for my final thoughts, I think in today's day and age where, as Larry has mentioned earlier, there is a lack of support and some misunderstanding on the policing profession, I have never been more proud of my employees, of my husband and of his colleagues, for still showing up every day and doing their job and serving the community that may not be looking favorably upon them. I agree with Larry when he said that it is a defining moment for policing. It is time for legitimate, critical discussion, and it will require the public to avoid extreme positions when it comes to policing, but it also requires police to not be defensive of some of the points that may come up. But it is definitely time to start the conversation.
I think you make a tremendous point. I can't really add anything of substance that's any more profound than what you all have said. I will say that I have had personal dealings with both the Regina Police Service and the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police. Did I do that right?
That was correct.
All right, cool. Fine organizations, both. I will say that I think everything you all have described, I think we'll know we're there when we get to that point where people treat the police department the same way they treat their city sports teams in terms of how they think about them. I mean, I'm a big hockey guy, and when you go to a hockey game or you watch a hockey game on TV, when that team comes out on the ice, they don't say, you know, here are the Regina Pats. You know, here are the Philadelphia Flyers. They say, here are your Philadelphia Flyers. Here are your Regina Pats. But my whole point is there's a community there. There's membership, there's togetherness, and there's unity. And so when you go to a community and ask them about the police department and you say the police department and their answer has my police department as the phraseology, I think that's a good litmus test for how close we might be to achieving this. It is a lofty goal. It's a worthwhile goal. And I hope that for those who have been listening, that hearing from these panelists maybe helps move us towards that goal, even just a single inch. I think that would make this time very well spent. I want to say thanks to Elizabeth, to Larry, and to Mick for being on the show today, and to George for letting us co-opt his microphone. And I wish you all well in the days to come.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, and I wanted to personally thank Elizabeth, Larry, and Mick for joining Frank in such an insightful and interesting conversation. If you enjoyed the work by Frank Scalise, I highly recommend checking out his personal podcast, Wrong Place, Right Crime, where he's joined by fellow crime fiction novelists to talk about their inspirations and experiences, which they bring to us via the written word. If you enjoyed the Rights and Wrongs podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon at Rights and Wrongs Pod, or supporting us directly, buying some merch on the website, or donating to us directly. The website is www.rightsandwrongspodcast.com. On the website, you'll also see articles. The articles are written by people such as yourself. You hear my voice enough, so I wanted to make sure that the articles are a place where you can express your voice. If you're interested in writing articles or even being on the podcast as a guest discussing any topic, feel free to email me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. Other than that, I would like to thank Larry, Mick, Frank, and Elizabeth once again for being a part of this project, and I hope everyone has a great day.